The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Everybody's participation in the service today, and Frank said that we need the messages, and so we'll see. hopefully, I do feel that I am inspired by God most of the time, but today's message is going to be a bit of a technical one, and we'll see how it goes. I'm having a little bit of difficulty juggling a lot of things in my head. I don't think it's just the message, it's just a lot of things going on, but hopefully I'll be able to relay what I feel needs to be said for today in preparation for tomorrow, and we'll all get something positive and helpful out of it. But before that, let's go ahead and have a few announcements. The first announcement I have is regarding my father, Russell Moore. He had two falls in the last week, and the first one was at a grocery store, and something else that it required somebody to come help him to get settled back at home. And then what is very common for people that have falls at his age is that within a week, it's very common for people to have a second fall, and so you need to be very careful about that. He did have a fall, and so he's in the hospital now. He has a cracked hip, and it's the kind of fracture that does not require surgery, which is good, but I guess it depends on how you look at it. Not so good in the sense that there's nothing that can be done except for to wait for hopeful healing. And there's going to be probably a long rehabilitation process. So he is in a lot of pain. I spoke to him yesterday. He's in a lot of pain. He is feeling very down. He's had quite a lot of grief since the passing of my mother last spring, the spring of last year. And he is 88 years old. And your prayers are appreciated. I had anointed a cloth and had that sent out to him. And any encouragement, of course, is helpful. And if anybody would like to send a card or something along, you can contact us, and we will relay the address of where he is staying for the next, I'm not sure, several weeks at least, I'm assuming. Okay, the next announcement is a comment and could be considered a possible correction in the sermon that was given last week. Last week, one of the focal points of that sermon was Reuel, who is also known as Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law. And I had said that this individual was also known as Hobab, according to Numbers 10, verse 29. And that name is given there in reference to an individual in relation to Moses, marital relation, that is. And just as a side, it's technically pronounced Chobab, almost like kebab, like a shish kebab, but with the ch, you know, that kind of a Hebrew or some might say Jewish expression in many terms. In any case, I had come to the conclusion that this was another expression for Reuel because of something that was written in Judges chapter 4 and verse 11. Judges chapter 4 and verse 11 says that Heber the Kenite of the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth tree at Zaanim. That reference to Hobab in the book of Judges in chapter 4 is portrayed as the father-in-law of Moses, and it appears to indicate, therefore, another name for Reuel, the priest of Midian. However, in Numbers 10, verse 29 that we read last week, it says that Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. So that reads as though Hobab is a son of Jethro, the priest of Midian. And so there appears to be obviously a conflict of terms here. There are two possible explanations for this. And in the book of Numbers, Hobab is considered the son of Reuel. And in the book of Judges, Hobab considered the father-in-law of Moses. So he can't be both. The first possible explanation is that there is a mistake in the translation or perhaps the transcription. Some think that there was, in fact, an error made in the book of Numbers, resulting in Hobab falsely being considered a son of Reuel in that book, and that the book of Judges is right in indicating that he was the father-in-law of Moses. However, it's also possible that the book of Judges has the mistranslation or mistranscription, and that Hobab should be considered actually a son of Reuel, which would make him not Moses' father-in-law. Hobab would be Moses' brother-in-law. So this obviously is not a salvational issue, but it's something worth noting because some people point to such things in the Bible as like, they made a mistake. We can just discredit so many other things in the Bible. But it's a mistake. These things were translated or transcribed, and transcribed from the hands of men, and for the most part, they are entirely accurate. So occasionally, there is a mistranslation or a mistranscription. So the possibility of a mistranslation may have something to do with the term that is translated as father-in-law. The term translated is the Hebrew kathan, which can mean to give away in marriage, as, you know, a father giving away his daughter to the bridegroom in marriage. But kathan can also mean to contract affinity by marriage. If you think about that, to contract affinity by marriage, this means that kathan can be referring to a father-in-law, but there are other affinities by marriage, a mother-in-law, a sister-in-law, and of course a brother-in-law. And for this reason, some could also suggest that this could be translated as brother-in-law in Numbers 10 and verse 29, where it speaks of Hobab. They say it should be say the brother-in-law of Moses, not the father-in-law of Moses. Now, there are there is another little caveat, if you will, to that, in that kathan is actually not translated as brother-in-law anywhere in the scriptures. However, the term brother-in-law is not found anywhere in the Bible. I was surprised when I tried to look this up. Okay, where else is the expression brother-in-law used in the Bible? I could not find it anywhere in the script. And if somebody is aware of some place where it says brother-in-law, and then we can look at the original Hebrew term to see if it is kathan, let me know. But I could not locate that term translated brother-in-law in the scriptures. Sister-in-law is found in the scriptures. You can find that expression in the Bible, but the term sister-in-law is not translated from kathan, interestingly. It's translated from an entirely different Hebrew term. And so the conclusion of this matter is that Hobab, being one and the same with Jethro, the priest of Midian, also known as Reuel, is inconclusive. I don't have a definite answer. Sometimes, I don't know, is the answer. It could be that Hobab was referring to the father-in-law of Moses, but it's also just as likely that it's referring to a brother-in-law that came with Jethro to Sinai with Israel camped there and continued with the people of Israel throughout their duration in the wilderness. Very long explanation for that, but if you don't quite get what I just related, we can talk about it later. It might take a little bit of time to digest that. The last announcement we have is that Pentecost, the count to Pentecost, the seventh week in this count concludes this evening, and tomorrow, beginning after sunset this evening, will be the 50th day, and we will therefore observe the Feast of Weeks. We will have a church service held in honor of God at the time. We'll have some food and fellowship. We will be meeting in a different location different hall than we are meeting today. This one will be in use tomorrow. And so it will be at the same time, 11 a.m. Mountain Time. And that service will be broadcast on the internet, and we will be attempting to broadcast it on the conference phone number as well for people that there are a handful of people that continue to use that electronic service. Let's go ahead and open your Bible to Exodus in chapter 19. Exodus in the 19th chapter. In the last chapter and the last sermon we had, last Sabbath, we had discussed some of the details about Moses being reunited with Zipporah and his sons, and also his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, who was, it was a very pleasant gathering that they had had. They had some food and discussion with other elders, and also we saw how this individual, Reuel, Moses' father-in-law, how he gave some important and helpful advice to help with the matter of the needed counsel and judgment within the camps of Israel. And so in that chapter, we saw that out of the many people called out of Egypt, the entire nation or all of the tribes and their, the children of Israel and also a mixed multitude, was that not all of them were to be leaders, that there was a fraction of people that were chosen to be leaders of thousands, leaders of hundreds, leaders of fifties, and leaders of tens. And so that conclusion can be related to the fact that God has been calling many people throughout the ages, but they are not all going to become leaders in his kingdom. As Christ had related, many are called, but few chosen. And so we are going to continue to discuss events of the Exodus, and we are going to see why it was decided that we should review all of these chapters, that we started doing this in chapter 1 of the book of Exodus, and we began this series before Passover, and we are going to conclude this series tomorrow during the church service held in honor of the Holy Day, the Feast of Weeks. And so let's go ahead and read the first two verses of Exodus 19, verses 1 and 2, where it says that in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. For they had departed from Rephidim, had come to the wilderness of Sinai, and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. And Tabitha, did you hand those out, please? Thank you. So the previous chapter's events, as well as those that we are going to discuss today and tomorrow, they began, as it says, to unfold during the third month of the year. And the timing of this is very interesting, and it is going to be one of the focal points of today's message. So if you would look at the handout provided, and also if you could switch on the internet to the screen that's titled Calends or Calendar, if you take a look at that there, I had created this spreadsheet showing the first, second, and third months of the year according to the information that we have in the book of Exodus. And that information is found in Exodus chapter 12 through chapter 19. And it's not in every chapter, but those are the chapters where these dates are given. So within these chapters, there are key dates, dates that can help us determine the week beginning with the first day of the first month that starts, as you can see on the first month there, it starts on the fifth day of the week, the day that we know as Thursday. And you might wonder, well, how can we know that? How did you figure that out, that is the first day of the first month of the year? Some 3,800 years ago, it's the fifth day of the week. Well, I'm going to explain this. We can know by considering something that God had said to Israel in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 1. Just turn back a page, perhaps two, depending on your printing of the Bible. Exodus chapter 16. And the first verse says that they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And so the 15th day of the second month is when the next events in chapter 16 began to unfold. And we covered those events 3 Sabbaths ago on May 25th when we discussed Mara, the manna, and the Sabbath test. And you can see on your calendar there the spreadsheet that I had created that I have this day marked with a rectangular block being a key to understanding the timing of events. And if you see the 15th day of the second month, that is a Sabbath. It's the seventh day of the week. How do we know that? Well, I'm going to talk about that for just a moment. If you go ahead and switch back to the camera, if you will, on the internet. What happened after this? They had come to this place, and it was the 15th day of the first month, is that God said that he would give them meat in the evening, and we know that came in the form of quail, and then manna the following morning, and they were told to gather a certain quota of manna each day for 6 days. In verse 5, if you'd look at Exodus 16 and verse 5, it says, "And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." Of course, talking about preparing for Sabbath, the day of preparation, gathering twice as much, bake what you will bake, boil what you will boil the day prior to Sabbath, and enjoy that the next day. So these were instructions that were given to Israel to become a weekly pattern to Israel. Of course, the weekly pattern would not include meat in the evening. They only received that a couple of times, and this is one of those times. And we can determine that the weekly pattern began on day one at sundown, after the Sabbath had ended, beginning the first day of the week. And, well, how do we know that? Well, let's continue and read just a little bit more in verse 6, where it says, Moses, this is chapter 16, verse 6, "Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, 'At evening you shall know that the Eternal has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Eternal, for he hears your complaints against the Eternal.'" And so how would they know? Well, they would know because God would bring quail that evening. And in the morning, you'll see the glory of the Lord, meaning you're going to see this manna all over the ground, and that's going to be bread for you, food for you to eat. So these events would begin on the first day of the week, which means at sunset, Arab. It's the expression meaning dusk after the sun has set. How can we determine that for certain? Well, go down to verse 12. "I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, 'At twilight,'" Arab, meaning sunset, "'you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Eternal, your God.'" And so it was that quails came up at evening. They covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost in the ground. And the children of Israel saw it. They said to one another, "What is it?" They didn't know what it is. And, you know, this is where the expression manna was developed. And so if you go down just a bit further, in verse 21, it says, "So they gathered it every morning, every man, according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted." And so it was on the sixth day, there's the key. And so it was on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses, "You know, we've done what the Lord has said." So God said that he would give them meat in the evening, and then bread from heaven in the morning, and they would gather it for 6 days, and then they would rest the seventh day, and that is the pattern. that began with meat in the evening, the first day of the week, gathering manna for 6 days. And this pattern began at sunset when the 15th day of the second month had ended. And that's why there is a block around that date on the spreadsheet, the calendar that I had created there. So if you consider this, why would God give them meat in the evening? Why choose to give it in the evening? As opposed to, why didn't he just give it after he told them, hey, I'm going to give you meat to eat, and here it comes. Here's the meat. Well, the reason was because God's decree came in response to complaints that were made on the Sabbath, on the weekly Sabbath. And God didn't want everybody running around trying to catch quail, dressing the animals, and then cooking it and boiling it, what have you, eating the fowl on the during the Sabbath. Nothing wrong with eating food, but not preparing it in that way. It would be inappropriate. So after Sabbath ended, Erev, twilight, dusk, the quail came, and then they gathered, they ate to the full, and of course the next morning there was manna, and they continued to gather the manna for 6 days. Now, if you'd look at your handout, and you can go ahead and switch back to the calendar on the internet, if you will. Recognizing that the 15th day of the second month was the Sabbath, I have added other dates to the calendar using the weekly cycle. Now we can count backward and forward in order to see what days certain events took place. And so the spreadsheet that I have in front of you, this uses months that each have 30 days. And that's familiar to most of us. 30-day months are the pattern, as depicted in the scriptures during the time of Noah. That's found in Genesis chapters 7 through 8. And also from the number of days portrayed in prophecies of Daniel and also in the book of Revelation, that God gives these indications of things that had occurred and will occur using 30-day months, each month having a total of 30 days. So God had said in the book of Exodus that Israel was to begin their months with a month called Abib. That was the name of a month that God did not give it. He didn't name it a month, the month of Abib. He simply used a term that had already existed. It's clear that the calendar that he told Moses to use for holy day observance was an acceptable, was an accurate way to keep track of days, months, and years. So notice on your spreadsheet, when we begin on the 15th day of the second month, the day there that's surrounded by a rectangular block, and that indicates that that is a date given in the Bible. We know that that's something that occurred in the scriptures, and we can count backward from the 15th of the second month all the way to the 15th of the first month, and then the 14th of the first month. And the 14th, of course, significant because that is when God said to observe Passover. And so we see that the 14th of the first month, that this was the fourth day of the week. It corresponds to the day that we know as Wednesday. And that was the day that Israel kept Passover and the 10th plague came. Now, clearly, and we should recognize the evening prior. We're very familiar with this expression. Passover observed the 14th, the evening prior. Why? Because God begins each day at sunset. That's when the day begins. So, if the sequence that I propose is correct, which I think it is, we find that some 1,500 years later, after that Passover was kept in Egypt, that the same sequence of days occurred when Christ kept his last Passover meal and he was crucified the next day on a Wednesday. His body was put in the sepulcher as the sun had set, beginning the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. As it says in the book of John, that day was a high day when he was put in the sepulcher, and his body stayed in the sepulcher all that night, and the next day would have been the Feast of Unleavened, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And then, of course, it stayed in the sepulcher all the next day and the next night, or next night and the next day. And then, of course, the next day and the next night, or vice versa. And he was raised from the dead as the sun had set when the Sabbath ended. Arab, twilight. So I think that's quite interesting to understand that the first Passover that God commanded the entire nation of Israel to observe fell on the same exact days that Christ kept his last Passover meal as the Passover Lamb of God. In addition, on this proposed calendar here, when we count forward, we had read in Exodus 19 and verse 1 that we have Israel before Mount Sinai on the first day of the first month. And that would be the second day of the week corresponding to Monday. And you see that there is a rectangular block around the first day of the third month being a Monday. That's when they arrived and encamped before the mountain. And I believe that we can know this because of the term that is used in verse 1 of chapter 19, on the same day. And I think that's indicating the first day of that month. So knowing that the count to the Feast of Weeks would have begun 3 days after the first high day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and you can look at the first month there, that's why I have a rectangular block around the 18th of the first month, because that would have been the day of the wave sheaf. Now, Israel, they did not wave a sheaf at that time. They were leaving Egypt. They had left. They had been on the road out of Egypt for 4 days now. So they did not wave a sheaf, and that command was given later in Leviticus 23. We find that record of the command to wave a sheaf, and we understand what that sheaf represents. We went through that. I'm sorry, you can go back to the podium now. We see that there is the command to wave the sheaf, and that sheaf represents Christ. And that's very important when we consider the relationship between the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the wave sheaf, and the Feast of Weeks, also known as Pentecost. And so when we determined that that was the day that a sheaf would have been waved, if it were commanded at that time, you count forward that week of the 18th in the first month would be week one in the count. The 25th, right below that, would be the beginning of week two. The second day of the second month would be the beginning of week three in the count. The 9th day of the second month would be the beginning of week 4. The 16th, the beginning of week 5. The 23rd of the second month, the beginning of week 6. And the 30th, the beginning of week 7. Now, the 30th would have been a Sunday, the first day of the week, clearly. And I guess, Bobby, I should have had you leave the calendar up there so people could follow along. But that's okay. You can leave it up if you have it. And that would be the beginning of week 7. And so here they are, the second day of the week in week 7 in the count to Pentecost, and they are before the mountain. And then what happens when that week ends on the 50th day? That would be the 7th, which is, again, shown by the rectangular block. That would be the observance of Pentecost. And this observance would have occurred approximately 6 days after they arrived before the mountain. And so let's go ahead and go back to the lectern, if you will. Thank you. With that in mind, let's consider, go back to Exodus 19, let's consider what took place after their arrival at the mountain of God in the wilderness of Sinai. In verse 3, it says, "And Moses went up to God, and the Eternal called to him from the mountain, saying, Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself." Now, the expression of being lifted out of Egypt or being born on eagle's wings. It points to a miraculous deliverance. We understand they walked out of Egypt, but they were supernaturally able to leave by miracles, first that were performed in Egypt, bringing down the pride of Pharaoh and that nation. And they were sustained by God. They were healed by God prior to leaving, so that it says later that there was none feeble among them. And they were sustained on the road out of Egypt, given the ability to travel day and night, a pillar of cloud and fire, and not just for light at night, but also clearly they must have been able to continue to walk and not have the need to stop and sleep 8 hours a day during the next several days out of Egypt. In addition, there were more miracles. We had read about those, the Red Sea crossing, the bitter waters of Marah. There was the meat to eat, and then the Sabbath manna being a Sabbath test to them. And there was also water from the rock in Horeb. So the expression "bore," attributed to eagle's wings, is synonymous with bear, which means to be responsible for. It can mean to carry or deliver, such as, you know, bearing a child, the mother bearing a child. And I believe that the miracles that I had just briefly mentioned, they're synonymous with God carrying them, delivering them out of Egypt, and depicted on the wings of an eagle. It's an illustration indicating that he was responsible in multiple ways, clearly, for bringing Israel out of Egypt and, as we had just read in chapter 19, to himself at the mountain. However, even though there is symbolism involved with this description of the wings of an eagle, it's possible that the reference is speaking of an angel that was instrumental in all of these events. And when we consider that there are animals that are on the earth that reflect angelic beings, and we have in several scriptures, such as Ezekiel chapter 1 and Revelation 4, we have examples of angels that have a face of an ox or the face of an lion or the face of an eagle. There are creatures at God's throne called beasts that obviously are reflective of animals, but they're not dumb animals. These are angelic beings that are a step above human beings. Also, Exodus 25 and verse 20, we have a depiction of cherubim, you know, chief angels that are at the throne of God, whose wings stretch out over the mercy seat. So the scriptures say that Israel was led out of Egypt by the angel of God, in Exodus 14 and verse 19. And that reference points to the messenger who is Christ, the angel of the Lord that spoke to Moses from the burning bush. And that's shown in Acts chapter 7 as well. And though the expressions may point to God being the director or orchestrator of these events, it could be that eagle's wings is also referring to a great angel that was highly involved with delivering the people out of Egypt. And the reason I make this connection is that the description of eagle's wings delivering people of God is also an expression that's used in Revelation in chapter 12, where it says that the woman representing the church, that she will be given wings of a great eagle so that she can fly to her place. And that's talking about the place of safety. And so the expressions are strikingly similar between what happened to the people in their exodus out of Egypt and also what will happen in the future. And I don't think they describe the exact same methods, but it's important to understanding that God is going to supernaturally deliver people in the future, just as he supernaturally delivered people in the past. However, there is a difference, because one group, it says, were brought out on eagle's wings, and it says that the future group, those people that are determined to be able to go to that place of safety, it says that they will be given the wings of a great eagle. And so a similarity and yet a difference, and if you would like to know more about that, Mr. Radick and myself had talked about it thoroughly in our booklet, A Place of Safety. Like what will happen in the future, God said that he brought those people to himself. It was for the purpose of coming to a place and a point where a proposal would be made with them. And the proposal included a covenant, and this covenant is much like a marital agreement between a husband and his wife. Notice the next verse, in verse 5 of chapter 19, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." So marital vows, they require a bride's commitment to be faithful to her groom. And the man will ask his bride, "Will you marry me?" And, you know, hopefully the woman responds with yes, or I will. And the commitment, of course, works both ways. The husband has to commit to be faithful to his wife as well. And he is to value her as special above all other people on the earth. Now, that does not mean that there's no regard for other people. It just means that his wife is like a treasure to him, at the top of the list, at top of his list. God first, of course, and I'm talking about human beings, but on the list, but God would be at the top, not a human being, but he's at the top, and then right below that, family, starting with your spouse. And so the God's proposal hints here initially, and I refer to this first exchange of words here between Moses, which he will go down and relay to the people, that it hints at the benefits to be gained if the people would say, "Yes, I will. We will do this and remain faithful." And God says, "For all the earth is mine." Wow. You know, a woman who marries a man, she becomes one with her husband, and then she becomes an inheritor or possessor of everything that he owns. And God here is saying, "All the earth is mine." Well, consider if you enter this covenant and you're faithful, then what would God give you? He's offering you the world here, okay? The best that the earth can bring forth can be yours. And the representation in this is that Israel was considered a congregation, translated in some places as the church in the wilderness. And Christ, well, he is seeking what? He is seeking a faithful bride to be found among members of his church. And there is prophesied to be a marriage supper. And Jesus said that those people who will become his bride, the meek, that they will inherit the earth. And he also said that theirs is the kingdom of heaven. An inheritor, a possessor of the things also that he owns. In verse 6, "And you shall be to me," again in this proposal, "you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." So did God intend for the entire nation of Israel, all of the tribes, to be a kingdom of priests? A holy nation? Well, it seems yes, that was his desire. He's not making this up here. He's not saying, "Oh, I'm just kidding. I'm only going to pick a certain people." But decisions determine destiny, right? Certainly, if all of the people did qualify to become a kingdom of priests, the purity of every family, having an acting priest would be ensured. But it became evident that the people were vastly not up to meeting those standards. And after the incident of the golden calf, God chose the tribe of Levi to be priests and the men of that tribe as a substitute for the consecration of the firstborn from all the tribes. And we read about that in Exodus 32, also in Numbers chapter 3, the conclusion of that matter. So what had happened in that God found it necessary to choose another tribe to be a tribe of priests is another example, I think, of God's long-term plan for all of mankind, beginning with the firstborn, those chosen for the first resurrection. It's reflected here in what happened with the people of Israel, that God called the entire nation of Israel out of Egypt. And he said, yes, you could be a kingdom of priests to me, all of you, a holy nation. But they were not all chosen to be priests. Just as many are called, but few will be chosen to be become kings and priests of God's kingdom. So most of Israel, we see, was disqualified from the position of being a part of the priesthood, and so we should remember that. Remember that story, this story, each day as we are told to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, because that's how you get it. That's how we get to the kingdom of God, through righteousness. Not saying, well, he's righteous, so I don't have to be. No, he was righteous, showing us so we are to be. How we are to be, that is going to determine whether we qualify for the kingdom. In verses 7 and 8, so Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before them all these words which the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Eternal has spoken, we will do. Again, this proposal, it's like a husband or a man proposing to his potential bride. Will you marry me? I'm offering you good things. All that I possess will be yours. I'll take care of you. You'll be a treasure to me. And they said, we will. We will do it. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Eternal. So God was proposing what was to be a lifelong commitment. And it's understood that agreeing to marry is the first step to taking actual vows. And in those vows, we agree to be faithful in sickness and in health, in good times and in bad. And so the actual terms of the covenant would soon follow this proposal. But before taking any further steps, God wanted to be sure. He wanted to begin by letting the people know, here's what's about to happen. Here's what I'm offering you. Do you agree? Are you ready for this? And the people responded, we will. We will do it. And Moses returned to God and relayed the people's response. Now, the situation of God asking and then needing to hear response, I believe, is evidence that there is no concrete destiny for each and every person on the earth that is predetermined by God. You know, God does not know every decision that you and I are going to make. He might have a good idea. Terry will probably choose this, and Michael will probably do that. He might consider and perhaps orchestrate situations at times where we'll make the choice that he would hope, that he would like us to make. But God does not know everything that we are going to do in life. If God was sure that the people would agree to this covenant, there would be no need to ask, no proposal necessary. And if he knew, you know, consider, if he knew that the majority of the tribes, that they would be disqualified as priests, a kingdom of priests, because of, you know, their unfaithfulness, and he would have to choose the tribe of Levi, he would never said, you are to be a kingdom of priests to me. But he did say that because that was his intention. That's what he wanted initially. But he had to change because of what the people did. He had to change his plan. So God would never have made a declaration initially for all the firstborn to be dedicated to him if he knew that the tribe of Levi would become a substitute for the firstborn. And that's what it says in Numbers chapter 3, that I'm going to choose Levi as a substitute now for the firstborn. So the point is something that we well understand. We have free will. We are able to choose which way we will go. And God doesn't always know if we are going to choose the right way or not. He might know who he's going to call ahead of time, But whether or not we make an adequate effort to fulfill that calling, well, that's up to us. Accepting Christ alone doesn't save us. You know, it's not believing in Christ. Some would say having faith in Christ, that's not the important part. The important part is having the faith of Christ. There are many people that say they believe in God, and they're not good people. They're not keeping the commandments. They're not observing holy days. They're not preparing for Christ's return. But they still say they believe in Christ. So that's of no value unless we have the faith of Christ. Okay, so a man and a woman who become engaged and then they get married, and they accept the vows to be faithful to one another, everything might start off well. And it seems as like, wow, this is just great, everything is going well. But what happens down the road is really what determines if this is going to last. Or if perhaps divorce might be necessary. God forbid, of course. Divorce is not God's desire. That's not what he wants. But like Israel, we find that sometimes it's necessary, isn't it? Jeremiah had said that God found it necessary to give the nation of Israel, or the northern kingdom of Israel, a certificate of divorce, he says. And he said, because I am married to you, but you're unfaithful, continually unfaithful, and so we're getting a divorce. But that's not what he wanted. That's not what he wanted for Israel initially. He wanted to have mercy, but continual unfaithfulness cannot continue to be forgiven if there are not fruits worthy of repentance. So the church of God is portrayed as a woman because of the covenant, just like Israel and the covenant that they made with God. And what we have in this first part of this chapter is it's likened to a proposal for marriage, and that's why we see in the scriptures numerous times that idolatry is compared to adultery. It's because it's a covenant, where we've made a covenant with God. And so being unfaithful to him is like committing adultery and being unfaithful to your spouse. Let's go ahead and read several more verses as we move toward the conclusion. We're in verse 9. After all the people answered and said that all that the Eternal has said we will do. Verse 9, and the Eternal said to Moses, behold, I come to you in the thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever. So Moses told the words of the people to the Eternal. And then the Eternal said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Eternal will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. You shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. Not a hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. And when the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. And he said to the people, be ready for the third day. Do not come near your wives. So it's talking about not having sexual relations. Not that there's anything evil with that, but for the greater sanctity of the day, he said, don't do this in preparation for God coming down and meeting with you, or at least speaking to you. So God instructed the people through Moses to get ready for this ceremony, if you will. Boundaries around the mountain were to be set as strict guidelines that if they were crossed, it was punishable by death, whether man or beast. And I think this is probably a lesson. You wonder why. Why would God do that? I think it's a lesson of presumptuousness is what it is. You know, here is God saying to the people through Moses that you're to be a kingdom of priests to me, a holy nation. But God was speaking nearly exclusively to Moses at this point, and Moses would continue to be his representative among the people. And so just because God was going to enter a covenant with the people of Israel and speak to everybody, it doesn't mean that you're all supposed to come up the mountain and talk to me. Mountains are used to represent a nation or government symbolically in the Bible, and this could be another example of needing to qualify to be a part of God's kingdom, to be a part of his mountain, meaning the government God, a holy nation. It's portrayed as Mount Zion. Matthew 22, and we're going to conclude over there as we talk just a bit more about this situation where Israel, they were told to get cleaned up and be ready for God to come and speak to you the words of the covenant, vows, if you will. Matthew 22. He told them to wash their clothes, and I think this is a way of saying, make yourself presentable. Let's get cleaned up. Let's get ready. Let's be dignified. Let's show some respect here. Just like if you were attending a marriage supper. And in this situation, I am at least reminded of the parable given by Christ where the kingdom of heaven is compared to a wedding feast that a king had arranged for his son. Now, in this parable, in Matthew 22, the king represents God the Father, who is planning a marriage supper for his son, and clearly referring to the Son of God. Matthew 22 and verse 1, that Jesus answered and spoke again by a parable and said, "The kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding. And they were not willing to come. So Israel, they were invited. And they knew in advance that God was coming. But when Christ came as the Messiah, they rejected him." And again, in verse 4, he sent out other servants, saying, "Tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen, my fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding." But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his servants and treated them spitefully and killed them. And this is talking about the prophets that God sent to Israel to tell them, "Turn back to me, be faithful to God, and be ready." But they mistreated those servants of God, the prophets. But when the king heard about this, in verse 7, he was furious, and he sent out his armies, and he destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. And this is comparable to what happened to the northern kingdom of Israel, and then the southern kingdom of the house of Judah. And he said to his servants, "The wedding is ready, but those who are invited, they are not worthy. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding." So God is calling others. And those servants went out in the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. And so all of the people that were called wanted to be a part of it. They all came, but we're going to see that they were not all ready. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. And so he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. He really didn't have an excuse. Then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot, take him away, cast him into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And here's the clincher. For many are called, but few chosen. A final point that I would like to make as we conclude is, again, about the timing of this event, the proposal, and then God declaring his vows, the covenant from Mount Sinai. You see, Israel had to come to the mountain in the beginning of the third month. And Moses had gone up and down the mountain several times before the people were given notice of, in 3 days, God is going to descend and he is going to speak to you. You're going to hear him speak. And so you don't have to turn back there, but in Exodus chapter 19 in verse 3, we see that Moses went up to the mountain, and he came down and relayed words from God to the people in verse 7. And he went back up and relayed words from the people to God in verse 8, and back down in verse 9, and then back up in verse 10, and then back down in verse 14. So it appears, anyway, you know, these could have happened, some of them could have happened in one day, I suppose, but it appears that there was probably a couple of days that this over which all of this took place, these conversations. And we can guesstimate as to the ascent and descent. It may have been a total, perhaps, of 3 days, considering that they came to the mount on the first day of the third month. And then after that conversation, the last conversation that's recorded anyway, we see that God gave them 2 days to prepare before he came to speak to them, and then he spoke to them on the third day. So Michelle walked away from the screen, but if you take a look at the handout, and we could have her pull up the screen real quick on the internet. Thank you for that. We'll look at that one last time. If they, in fact, did arrive before the mountain on the first day of the third month, as indicated by the expression on the same day, as I had pointed out, and we have that in a rectangular box here in the handout. If that is, in fact, the day that they came in, we have 3 days of words exchanged between God and Moses, 1, 2, 3, and then that would be the fourth day of the third month. And then we have the 2 days of getting ready, sanctification, washing, and setting boundaries around the mountain. And that would be 1, 2. That would then, you know, this Saturday, the Sabbath, would be the last day before God spoke to them. And then the seventh day of the third month is what? Pentecost. That's the Feast of Weeks that we will be observing tomorrow. So let's go ahead and switch back to the screen, if you will, the lectern, if you could. Thank you, Michelle. Before God spoke to the people, there would be the loud, startling, perhaps moving at least, at minimum, sound of an angelic trumpet being blown. And we see that God would later, in the book of Numbers, in chapter 10, he would later command that silver trumpets were to be made and used by the priesthood, and that those trumpets were to be blown at specific times. And some of those times were the weekly Sabbath and on each holy day, each high holy day. And so with all of these things falling in line and all of the symbolism involved, I would not say that that it's possible that the Ten Commandments were declared from Sinai on the same day as the observance of the Feast of Weeks, but I would say that it's probable. In other words, highly likely that they were declared on the day of Pentecost. And so tomorrow we're going to hear more about that covenant, and also we'll be hearing about the true meaning of Pentecost when we observe this second time a year when all your males are required to appear before the Lord and to bring an offering, the Feast of Weeks.